Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word podcast dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and I'm here to tell you exactly what I think of some of the latest movies out right now. For this show, I have four new movies to review for you, all of which can be found on Netflix, because that is actually my only streaming service right now. And movie theaters are still closed. And given the state of the coronavirus right now, while I miss the movie theaters, I'm not going to go rushing back into them just because I miss them, because I am still fearful for my health. And if you are of competent sound mind, you should be as well. That's a whole other topic, a much more serious topic, but for this show, I'm just going to review the movies that I've seen recently. And actually, last week, I couldn't do my show because there was a blackout here at the station. Not only were the lights out, but the station itself was just not even operating automatically like it normally does when no one else is here. So I have some movies from last week that I was going to review for you to catch up on this week. And I'm going to start things off by reviewing my first movie, which is The Old Guard. This is a movie that came out on July 10th. And it is a movie about a covert team of immortal mercenaries who are suddenly exposed for being immortal, which can be dangerous to them, despite the fact that they can't die, and must now fight to keep their identity a secret just as an unexpected new member is discovered. The Old Guard stars Charlize Theron, and in strong supporting roles, there are also the actors Kiki Layne, Matthias Schoenaerts, Marwane Kenzari, and Lucas Marinelli. And they are pursued by one particular vigilante who's not immoral, whose name is Copley, and he's played by Chiwetel Ejiofor in a very strong supporting performance. The Old Guard is actually based on a graphic novel series written by Greg Rucka, who also wrote the screenplay to this film. And other than the fact that the heroes, the antagonists of the movie, are immortal, it is mainly a standard action film, but I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, maybe the action sequences weren't particularly groundbreaking, but I did like Charlize Theron in the movie. I thought she acted well as usual, and she was also very funny in a deadpan sort of way. I also really liked Kiki Layne in this film as the reluctant vigilante Nile. And she plays someone who is a Marine in the Afghanistan War, and after a particular attack on her, a surprise attack, which probably would have cost her death in normal circumstances, she's still very much alive. And right when the Marine Corps is about to send her to Germany to be experimented upon to see exactly why she survived like she did, Charlize Theron swoops in and rescues her, killing some Marines in the process, and the story to this film really begins. Now, Kiki Layne is an actress whose name is not particularly familiar yet, but some people who have been going to movies frequently, particularly in art house cinemas, probably know her best in the lead role of in the movie If Beale Street Could Talk, in which she was very good. There were a lot of great actors in If Beale Street Could Talk, one of whom won an Academy Award, deservedly, Regina King, in 2018 for Best Supporting Actress, and she definitely deserved that. Kiki Layne has also been in Native Son. She's actually going to be in the upcoming Eddie Murphy film Coming to America. That's not to be confused with the 1988 film. This is the sequel, which has the number 2 replacing the word 2 in it. It's difficult to explain when I put it that way, but it's the sequel to 1988's Coming to America. So I'm very interested to see her in that as well. That's probably her first comedy. But The Old Guard, I think she acts very well in this movie, as does Charlize Theron. They play very well off one another. And I guess there isn't really too much else to say about this film. I'm afraid that if I give away crucial parts in this movie, it's of course going to spoil it for those of you who can watch it out there. But I did like the fact that living forever in this universe can actually work against you. It may not lead to death, which I think is the root of all humans' fears, but if you don't have that root of death as a fear, then there's probably going to be something else that's going to take its place. That's what I appreciated about The Old Guard, but I felt like for a movie that's based on a graphic novel series, there was more that could have been put into it. But at the same time, I do think that the content of the movie, aside from the action scenes, were interesting enough so that you would want to see either a prequel or a sequel to this film. I actually think that a prequel would probably be even more fascinating than a sequel to this film, particularly because when Chiwetel Ejiofor's character is researching these mercenaries who happen to have lived for at least a few hundred years, he comes across some black and white photographs, like one of Charlize Theron, presumably in the Civil War. And I thought, you know, kind of like Wonder Woman, I would have thought it would have been great if you had seen her living forever and I want to say coming of age through this past, but if you're immortal, you don't exactly come of age, but then again, you'd have to have been born somehow. But The Old Guard raised a lot of interesting questions. I think questions that could inevitably be answered in a sequel. And I do think actually the sequel has the potential to be better than the original, but overall, I enjoyed The Old Guard. The only thing was that I thought that the action sequences, while some were inspired, most of them were kind of run-of-the-mill, and that disappointed me a little bit. But not too much that I wouldn't recommend this film, and for that reason, I give The Old Guard a marginal knockout. And by that I mean, I'd probably give the movie an A- or a B+ if I was giving out grades that way, but I do think it's definitely worth seeing. I think the acting, particularly by Charlize Theron, Kiki Layne, and Chiwetel Ejiofor, two out of three of whom are Academy Award nominees, one out of three of whom is an Academy Award winner, I thought they made the film at a higher level than other actors who would have been in this movie, like Michelle Rodriguez or Vin Diesel, who might have been the go-to people when it came to such action films like this. But The Old Guard, I give it credit, even though the action sequences weren't particularly anything memorable, I do think that the acting and the writing of the dialogue made this movie a lot smarter than maybe some other studios besides Netflix would have been willing to make it. And for that reason, I think The Old Guard is worth checking out. The Old Guard, by the way, is a Netflix original, and that means that you can, if you have a Netflix account, you can go stream it right now. I do think, even though it's great that I could say, this is a movie I recommend, you should go check it out. While I do like that it's easy for me to recommend movies you can stream, I still miss the movie theaters. I guess I've explained that already enough in my original monologue before getting into my first review, but I really do miss it, and I do think The Old Guard would have been best seen on the big screen as opposed to on your TV or on your laptop at home. But regardless, I think if you can see it on your laptop or your TV screen, I suppose it's worth it. I just think that it would have been better suited for the big screen. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Desperados, which is a romantic comedy directed by somebody known as LP. I have never heard of any directors who are known only by their initials. I know a couple of directors who are known by a nickname of some sort, but yeah, never initials. So That immediately struck me. Why would somebody just be known by their initials? Is it one of those instances like Alan Smithy where a director is dissatisfied with the way the studio recut their film, so they just took their name off it? I don't know. But Desperados is a comedy. It's a romantic comedy, actually. That is considerably predictable in several instances. But I liked it because of the lead actress in the film, Nassim Pedrad. And for those of you who don't know Nassim Pedrad, she is one of the more recent cast members of SNL. And she, unfortunately, has not gotten quite the same attention as other female cast members of the last 20 or so years, like Amy Poehler, Kristen Wiig, Kate McKinnon, Cecily Strong. But she is immensely talented. And ever since she left Saturday Night Live, I hoped she would have a successful post-SNL career similar to Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, and Maya Rudolph, and maybe less like Gilda Radner, Jan Hooks, or Sherry O'Terry, in that you see them on SNL, they're brilliant, and then when they leave SNL, that you don't hear very much from them. But fortunately, I think Nassim Pedrad is getting not quite as much recognition as she deserves, but it's a pretty good start. But in Desperados, Nassim Pedrad plays a panicked young woman who, with her reluctant friends in tow, rushes to Mexico from Los Angeles to try and delete a ranting email she sent to her new boyfriend. So Nassim Pedrad plays a woman by the name of Wesley, who's in her mid-30s and still doesn't have a husband or even a boyfriend at that point. And I think, like many people I know in their early, mid, or late 30s, they're reevaluating their life and wondering why it is that their life isn't quite the way they want it to be. So Wesley has two friends upon whom she relies. There's Brooke, who is a mother whose husband cheated on her, who's played by Anna Camp. And there's another friend by the name of Kaylee, who doesn't have too much of a backstory, but she's a more neurotic best friend who's played by Sarah Burns. And I think to this movie's credit, Nassim Pedrad, Anna Camp, and Sarah Burns play very well off each other, and I actually believed them to be best friends, even though I don't think they'd ever worked together previously. But Wesley has her own romantic issues to deal with. And it starts off with a blind date with a guy by the name of Sean, who's played by an actor named Lamorne Morris. And Lamorne Morris is one of those actors whose name isn't particularly familiar, but you probably know him as the actor who played Wynton Bishop, one of Zooey Deschanel's three male roommates in New Girl. He also played some previous smaller roles in Barbershop: The Next Cut from 2016, Sandy Wexler, the Adam Sandler film that was a Netflix original from 2017, and also a movie that kind of came and went, which was called Game Night, starring Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams. He's mainly known for his supporting roles, but he is very funny and naturally so. But the blind date doesn't end particularly well, and Wesley walks out of the restaurant where she's basically thrown out of her blind date. And I actually think that the dynamics of that brief blind date are really good. I think the dialogue in it is very funny and very inspired and also feels very true to life. But that actually is all too brief a scene. But I do think that Nassim Pedrad and Lamorne Morris play very well off one another. But when Wesley, Nassim Pedrad's character, leaves the restaurant, she falls, hits her head, and is assisted by a very handsome young man by the name of Jared, who's played by Robbie Amell, who is almost too good to be true. Not only is he really good looking, but he also owns a very nice house in the greater Los Angeles area and begins a relationship with Wesley. But things fall apart when, after a bit of a one-night stand the two of them have, Wesley doesn't hear from him for about 3 or 4 days, prompting her to write a very angry and regrettable email. And once she sends the email out, this guy calls her and says, "I'm sorry I haven't called you in 3 or 4 days. I've been in Mexico and I've been in a coma." Which sounds to me like a really, really lame excuse for not calling someone, But Wesley believes it in this movie, and it happens to be true. But yeah, it sounds like a really lame excuse. Being in Mexico and being in a coma for 3 or 4 days, what are the odds, really? But in the scope of this film, and this is kind of where the movie sort of falls apart, Wesley begins to regret the angry email she wrote and recruits her two friends to go to Mexico with her, break into her presumed temporary boyfriend's hotel room, get into his computer, provided they're lucky enough not to have it locked by a passcode, and erase the email from there. So I guess you could probably say that shenanigans ensue, and that is ultimately true in Desperados. And I did think there were actually some scenes that were funnier than the otherwise predictable plot allowed, but I do also think that realistically, I don't particularly think that somebody who wrote one of these angry, regrettable emails would go that far to get it erased. In other words, going to another country, either, you know, flying or driving a few hours to get there, just to the slim chance of breaking into somebody else's apartment only to get into their computer and erase their email. That seems like way too many steps. I think the first thing I would do in that situation before going to Mexico would be asking people if they knew a hacker who'd be able to get into the person's email and erase it from there, and that's all they need to do. And I think that this comedy could have had some other more realistic scenarios from there, but I did not hate this movie. If anything, I think that Nassim Pedrad played her role very well. I did think there were parts of the movie where she was very needy and very whiny, but not so much that I didn't side with her character. I just thought that the plot itself was a little too outrageous than it needed to be. Also, there is a very useless supporting role in this movie by Heather Graham, who plays this guru who begins to take Anna Camp's character under her wing. And the scenes between Anna Camp and Heather Graham could have been funnier, but they kind of deviate from the point of the rest of the movie, which is really too bad. And once the scene ends, it's never brought up again. And when movies do that, you can kind of tell that they were a little strapped for subplots. And I do think that's one of the main problems with Desperados. Also, another thing about the movie Desperados that sort of rubbed me the wrong way is the name of the movie. Because when I think of Desperado, I either think of the song by the Eagles, which I know every word to, or I think of the 1995 Robert Rodriguez-directed action film starring Antonio Banderas. And Desperado is another name. I think it's a slang term, not a legitimate Spanish term, for outlaw. And that doesn't particularly pertain to the characters in this film. And plus, Desperados is plural. Is that referring to Nassim Pedrad's character and her friends? Is it referring to her character and the guy with whom she went on a blind date, who coincidentally happens to be going to Mexico at the same time as she is and staying in the exact same hotel that she is? I don't know. I suppose it could happen. Life is strange enough. It seems like the political climate we're in right now is stranger than fiction. And a lot of people say you couldn't make this stuff up. And that's a saying I don't really particularly like. You could make anything up. It's just a matter of whether or not people believe it. So there is a lot that's far-fetched in Desperados. I think that at its worst, it does follow a predictable romantic comedy plot. But I do think that Nassim Pedrad and the dialogue she's given make this movie at least worth seeing. And certainly for a girl's night in, particularly in this COVID-19 pandemic we're in, I think it fits. And it also is somewhat of a fun summer movie. So for that reason, I give Desperados my rating of a marginal checkout. I do think that Nassim Pedrad has the talent, and particularly that which she showcased on Saturday Night Live, to eventually be in a better film, and she deserves to be in better movies. But this is a pretty good start. I wouldn't rate this as a complete failure of a film. It's just, it follows the standard romantic comedy formula. Although, had this been written by a man, it would have been far more formulaic, both in plot and in dialogue. And fortunately, writer Ellen Rappaport gives these characters a lot more dimension than I think most male screenwriters would. And I give it a marginal recommendation because of that. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Ride Like a Girl, which is a movie that was made last year, but debuted in America, at least on Netflix, this year. And it's directed by Rachel Griffiths, who is an actress and director who has been in several American films. She actually had a role opposite Julia Roberts in My Best Friend's Wedding way back in 1997. She also was in an Australian film called Hillary and Jackie. She played Johnny Depp's mother in the movie Blow. But even though she's an actress, she does not appear in this film. Ride Like a Girl is, as I said, a true story, and it's based on a woman by the name of Michelle Payne, last name spelled P-A-Y-N-E, an Australian native, who became, in 2015, the first female jockey to win the Melbourne Cup. And this movie not only tells a story about Michelle Payne, but also of the Payne family. Michelle Payne, who in this movie is played by a lovely young actress by the name of Teresa Palmer, is the youngest of 10 children of racehorse trainer Patty Payne, who is played by Sam Neill. And Sam Neill is a New Zealander, so not exactly Australian, but if you consider Australia the continent of which New Zealand is a part, then yes, technically Sam Neill is Australian, but I don't think native Australians will really care that he plays an Aussie when he's really a Kiwi. But anyway, almost all of Patty's children grow up to become jockeys, and their youngest daughter has a few odds against her, particularly being a woman who is vying to win the Melbourne Cup. I don't think she was the first woman to race in the Melbourne Cup races, but she is definitely the first person to win, and her being a woman, the odds are against her. And I actually found the title of this movie, Ride Like a Girl, a little strange, because how do you ride a horse like a girl? I think the way a girl rides a horse is the same way a guy rides a horse. They just get up on the saddle and go, right? I don't think there's really a girly way in any conceivable, stereotypical way to ride a horse, is there? I mean, I've heard of throw like a girl. I've heard of hit like a girl. I've heard of a lot of other things like a girl. I've never heard of ride like a girl being a legitimate insult. But regardless, Ride Like a Girl, I think, is a lot more predictable a sports story than Desperados was a romantic comedy. And I did actually like Sam Neill in the film. I think he is a great actor, always has been, whether he's in American movies like Jurassic Park or movies that are filmed in New Zealand, like Hunt for the Wilder People. Hunt for the Wilder People was the highest grossing film in New Zealand. I think it did very well in Australia, and it came to the United States, and while it wasn't an especially big hit here, Hunt for the Wilder People did receive rave reviews. Sam Neill played Uncle Heck in that movie, who served as a really good straight man in that film. And he also made a cameo, Sam Neill did, in Thor Ragnarok, which was also directed by Taika Waititi. Anyway, That's enough about Sam Neill. Now about the movie Ride Like a Girl. I did think that when the movie wasn't quite as predictable as a sports story, it probably shined a lot more. Like, for instance, I really liked the scenes between Teresa Palmer and Michelle Payne's brother, Stevie Payne, who is probably has less of a chance of winning the Melbourne Cup than she did because he has Down syndrome. And Stevie Payne, by the way, plays himself in the movie, which I thought was a very good move. I mean, another actor of Down syndrome could have played this part, but I think that Stevie Payne playing himself, it's very easy to play yourself in a movie, even if you've had no acting experience. But I do think that Stevie Payne and Teresa Palmer work very well off one another, and I think it makes the story even more inspiring. And I think there are actually moments where Michelle Payne, Teresa Palmer's character in the film, has some moments where there are more odds that are against her besides her being a woman, including one particular accident into which she gets when she is training for the Melbourne Cup races. I thought the scene was very well done. I was very shocked that she actually recovered from this, and maybe that's spoiling a little bit, but I do have a rule on Words on Film about being spoiler-free, but when a movie is based on a true story, I do make a slight exception. But at the same time, I also told you that it was predictable, a little bit of a predictable sports drama film, but I did like other aspects about it. And for that reason, I give it my rating of a checkout because Teresa Palmer acts well in this film. I think Sam Neill and Stevie Payne are very worthy supporting actors. And you can't really go wrong with a true story like this. It happened not too long ago. It is very inspiring. I think it will definitely inspire a lot of women, maybe not to ride horses, but if that's what they want to do, then all the power to them. But it will also maybe inspire them in other sports as well. And I think even though the sports drama plot is a bit predictable, especially when you realize that she made history doing this, I still think there's more to take away from this film than the predictable plot. And for that reason, I did enjoy Ride Like a Girl. It just didn't have that X factor to be a great film. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is a film that is a Netflix original that actually debuted at the Tribeca Film Festival this year, one of the few festivals that was not canceled. However, the Tribeca Film Festival did have to make some amenities to their film screenings, and very much like several independent theaters out there, they probably had to stream a lot of their movies as opposed to open up theaters, and that's fine because I think, if anything, obviously movie theaters all over the country are hurting, but the ones that are hurting the most are the indie theaters. Maybe not so much the multiplexes that show the mainstream films. But then again, people can tune into mainstream films on demand, but most independent films don't quite have that luxury, although that is changing a little bit because of this pandemic, because going to the movies is not an option. What was I talking about again? Yes, the movie. The movie, which is a Netflix original, and by Netflix original I mean that Netflix acquired the distribution rights to this film, is one called Nobody Knows I'm Here, also known by its Spanish name, Nadie Sabe Que Estoy Aquí. It is a Chilean drama directed by Gaspar Antillo and starring Jorge Garcia, better known as Hurley from Lost, and he's been in other movies as well. It also co-stars Nelson Brote, Juan Falcón, and Julio Fuentes. And it is Netflix's first Chilean original movie. And I believe that it's filmed in Chile, but the language in the film is Brazilian Portuguese. Or at least that was the language that I had set on Netflix. When I first turned on the movie, I could hear the English dub of the film, and I thought, I'm not going to watch it like this, because English dub, well, dubbing of any kind, of any language, usually tends to sound fake, with the exception of people who dub anime or animated movies from other countries, not just Japan. But live-action films, whenever they dub them, it just sounds fake, and it takes me out of the movie. So a lot of people, particularly Americans, do not like to go to foreign independent films because they don't like to read the text on the bottom of the page. I can understand that frustration. I don't mind it, but I can understand that. But I would rather hear the characters' real voices and read what they mean underneath than have somebody translate into English and just sound completely fake. But Nobody Knows I'm Here stars Jorge Garcia as a former child singer by the name of Memo Garrido, who lives with his uncle Braulio in a small town in Llanquihue, which is in southern Chile. And despite having been active in the entertainment industry as a child, Memo, Jorge Garcia's character, lives a life of mostly seclusion. This small island is where a lot of people rely on fishing, not only for the economy, but also just to fish for their own food. And he is still challenged by his life as a former child singer. And when I say former child singer, I don't mean former child star. It shows him in flashbacks, or a child who looks a considerable amount like Jorge Garcia as a young boy, singing into a microphone in a studio. But then eventually you realize that as the adults in the studio are talking, they don't exactly look out for Memo's best interests. Let me be more specific. Memo can sing, and all the adults know that, but he doesn't have the look that these executives are looking for in a teen singer. They want someone with whom teenage girls can fall in love. So Memo serves as the singing voice for a much more good-looking child star. And a lot of you would think that wouldn't happen today. Well, first of all, you didn't know that. You don't know that. It could still happen today. And secondly, if you really look back at some of the music history up until probably the mid-90s, there were more singing acts who lip-sync than Milli Vanilli. In fact, the woman who was in the music videos for CNC Music Factory, she lip-synced. There were various other techno acts where there was a woman who was in the music video, but it wasn't her voice that was coming out of the speakers. So it happens more in the music business than you think. In fact, there could be another scandal where another star of the Disney Channel turns out not to sing his or her own songs. It wouldn't surprise me if there was. And I'm not saying that former child stars are lip-syncing, but I bet there's going to be either one now or one that's coming up where music executives decide to take the easy way out and have a literal facade with somebody else's singing voice. It could happen. But The really fascinating parts of this film, Nobody Knows I'm Here, are the on-location Chilean filming in the small island in Yanquehe, which is the Chilean town I just mentioned. And I liked, actually, I thought the flashbacks were put into the film very well. At first, you're thinking maybe Mamo is bitter about his providing the voice for a kid who ultimately became world famous, whereas he was on the sidelines despite it being his own voice. And it turns out there was a lot more to that story than just resentment. And there's one particularly shocking twist that I won't give away. But one of the biggest selling points of this film is the relationship between Mamo and a young woman who lives near Yanquehe, whose name is Marta. And she does not know his past, but he has her attention, but he keeps pushing her away. And for a guy who looks like Jorge Garcia to get that kind of attention from a woman without being famous himself, I hear he has a very beautiful girlfriend. But yeah, I think if he wasn't on Lost and there wasn't a Weezer album named after him with his face on the cover, which there is, look it up. I don't particularly think that women would be fighting over him, but that's not to say that he doesn't have intangible qualities to him. I'm just saying, realistically, that might not happen. But I'm not saying that this movie is unrealistic in that either. I'm just saying you must have some sort of hidden charisma to get a woman's attention on such a remote island in a small southern Chilean town, presumably in the middle of nowhere. But I really liked the love story that played out between Mamo and Marta. I loved the backstory behind Mamo's way of becoming a recluse. And I also think the movie ended really well when somebody who's hosting a talk show is trying to track down Mamo and get him on a talk show with the former child star singer whose voice he used and took full credit for using. There is a really interesting way that all played out, and I think the film is shot incredibly well. I would probably urge people to watch this in Spanish or Portuguese, not in English, but I think Jorge Garcia does a really good job in this film. And the only other drama in which I've seen Jorge Garcia act is a little scene film called The Good Humor Man, which takes place in the mid-1970s. And Jorge Garcia plays a guy who comes off at first as kind of a John Belushi, Bluto Blutarski guy who's larger than life. But then the film takes a really dark turn with his character. And I'm really actually kind of disappointed that I'm one of the only ones who's seen The Good Humor Man, but that's partly what this show is about. It's about going out there and checking out movies that I'm recommending to you. And because I'm recommending them to you, I am always right. I'm just kidding. It's really a matter of opinion. But Nobody Knows I'm Here gets my rating of a knockout. I think it's a brilliant film. I think it is a potential contender for best foreign language film or best foreign film at the Oscars next year. But I would love to see, and I'm not guaranteeing this will happen, but I would love to see the song in the movie, which is also called Nobody Knows I'm Here, get nominated for an Oscar. But then again, I think the Oscars, particularly when it comes to categories like best score and best original song, I do think they favor the bigger budget films than they do the independent films, because there was a film that came out last year, which was called Hearts Beat Loud, which was an independent film starring Nick Offerman and Kiersey Clemons, which had a song in there, which was also called Hearts Beat Loud. And the song was beautiful. I thought it was great. I thought Kiersey Clemons sang it very well. And I thought it was a good modern music film. But it wasn't nominated for Best Original Song. I think in a perfect world, I could pick the Oscar picks, but then again, I might miss some good movies as well. But Nobody Knows I'm Here is a movie that I recommend. It is a drama that has some very dark parts to it and characters that do things that have long-term consequences for everyone involved. And that's really not easy to watch, but I do recommend it. And for people who maybe don't want to stay in and have a good time watching a film, but somebody who has the right mindset to watch a dramatic film and really be emotionally challenged, I think Nobody Knows I'm Here is the right film for that. And it actually is one of my favorite films of the year so far. I've reviewed all the films that I have to review for you for this show, so I might as well give you a spoken word preview, not of films that are coming out in theaters, as I normally do, but rather films that are coming out on streaming platforms. And I'm going to start with Netflix. There are a few films that are Netflix originals. I'm going to try to focus on those, and I'm also going to exclude series, because I think the only series that might make it on Words on Film are limited series, ones that have only about 3 or 4 episodes, and there are no plans to release further episodes of those. So let me check out movies that are coming out this coming week. There's a film premiere that's called The Players that's coming out on Wednesday, July 15th. Its actual name is Glee Infideli. Les Infidelis, that's actually the name of the film, is a series of short films set around the theme of infidelity. And one of the stars of the movie is Jean Dujardin, who was the star of, and the Academy Award-winning star, no less, of the modern silent film The Artist, which I guess a lot of you haven't seen. I guess some people don't have the patience for silent movies, and trust me, I'm with you there, but The Artist is an exceptional film. It's very funny. I think it's extremely well done. And also, while Jean Dujardin hasn't had many film roles after The Artist, or at least not in America, he did have a supporting role in The Wolf of Wall Street, which was notable, and kudos to Martin Scorsese for giving this French actor at least some American recognition that he deserved, you know, being an Academy Award winner and all. But that movie, Les Infidelis, which is also called Gli Infideli, which I think might be Italian, is going to come out on Netflix on Wednesday, July 15th. So I definitely am going to check that out, and I'll let you know what I think on next week's show. Another film that's coming out is one that's called Fatal Affair. This is another Netflix original. Again, not a very inspired title for a film. But Fatal Affair is a movie that stars Nia Long and Omar Epps, two excellent actors. It is about a person by the name of Ellie, I assume the woman, who tries to mend her marriage with her husband Marcus, it is a woman, after a brief encounter with an old friend David, only to find that David is more dangerous and unstable than she'd realized. That sounds a lot like Fatal Attraction, just kind of gender flipping right there. So I don't know if this film is going to be very good. It's a shame that such good actors like Nia Long and Omar Epps are in a movie that sounds formulaic. But I will give this movie a chance. It may not be the ripoff of Fatal Attraction that it sounds like, but I will check it out, and I'll let you know what I think on next week's show. Another film that's coming out on Netflix that same day, Wednesday, July 15th, is one that is called MILF. And MILF is a film that actually came out in 2018, but it is premiering on Netflix on Wednesday, July 15th. It is a film that is not American, actually, because, and the ironic part about that is that MILF is definitely an American term, but this film is actually French, and it's about three best friends in their 40s, all women, who start a relationship with younger men while on vacation. Now, just because the women are in their 40s doesn't mean they're MILFs, because the first letter of MILF stands for mother. So a MILF would technically be someone who has given birth to one or more children. If, I guess whether or not, I guess I'm digging myself into very awkward subject matters right here, but MILF looks like an interesting film. It's obvious somebody who was American gave the movie that title. I don't know. I mean, movies that are based on sex, for some odd reason, don't tend to be very good films. When you think about movies like Deep Throat, Fritz the Cat, Benny and June, 50 Shades of Grey, all of these are films that are based around sex, but they're not very good films to begin with. And I've always wondered why that is, why somebody can't make a really good erotic thriller and have the selling point be sex. But I think the filmmakers or maybe the producers get a little lazy, thinking that if it turns them on one way, they won't care about anything else like story or character. And I think that's usually the trap to which movies fall. It doesn't usually hurt them financially, but it does hurt the movie in the grand scheme of things. But I guess it all depends on the person who's making it, the person who's releasing it, and their motivation, whether or not they want to have a glamorized porn film or whether they want to have sex as a viable subplot of a movie, but not a selling point. I don't know. I guess the movie industry is fickle at times. And I guess that's pretty much it for all the Netflix originals. There are other movies that are being released on Netflix beginning this week, but they're not films that are Netflix originals. One of them is the version of Pride and Prejudice, the Jane Austen novel from 2005, starring Keira Knightley as the Bennet sister. I want to say Elizabeth. Yes, Elizabeth Bennet, and I'm right. And some of the other Bennet sisters in the film include Tallulah Riley, who plays Mary Bennet, Rosamund Pike, who plays Jane Bennet, I think the eldest sister, Jenna Malone, who plays Lydia, and Carey Mulligan, who plays Kitty. And I think Carey Mulligan played Kitty Bennet when she was a young girl. Donald Sutherland, an American, is Mr. Bennet, probably my favorite character from Pride and Prejudice. Yeah, Pride and Prejudice is a book that, while I am glad that modern audiences are not only watching the films, but also reading the book by Jane Austen, I read the book myself, and it really isn't my kind of story. It is basically a lot of gossip, a lot of letter writing, and it took me a long while to get through the book. It was actually Mark Twain who said, and I quote, "Every time I read Pride and Prejudice, I want to dig Jane Austen up from her grave and hit her in the head repeatedly with her own shin bone." End quote. Mark Twain, I absolutely agree with you there. But then again, Mark Twain did say, "Every time I read Pride and Prejudice." He didn't say, "When I read Pride and Prejudice once," which sort of suggests and implies that Mark Twain kept coming back to the book for some reason. And that says something, I think, universally about Jane Austen. But then again, Jane Austen does have her critics, and Mark Twain was one of them. But I hear great things about the 2005 version of Pride and Prejudice, which was far from the first adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, and it definitely will not be the last, especially because there are other movies that are based on Jane Austen books, like Sense and Sensibility, one I really actually liked as a movie, which was called Love and Friendship, which was based on a book by Jane Austen that was one of Jane Austen's unfinished books, which was released posthumously. But Pride and Prejudice will be on Netflix on Thursday, July 16th. So if you want to check it out, you're absolutely welcome. And I think the other movie that's coming out of note is on Friday, July 17th, and it's a film called Funan. And Funan, I'm looking up right now, thank God for fast internet, it is a 2018 film that is actually animated, which is great, so I'll definitely see this one. It's directed by a director by the name of Dennis Doe, who is presumably Japanese, and Funan feels like an anime film, or at least one that is animated by somebody Japanese, because the characters are Japanese. And it tells the story of the survival and struggle of a young mother during the Khmer Rouge Revolution to find her 4-year-old son torn from his family by the regime. This movie, again, came out in 2018. It made it to several film festivals, but received 3 minor wins from the Annecy International Animated Film Festival. It won Best Sound Design and Best Writing in a Feature Film at the Emily Awards, E-M-I-L-E. It's either Emily or Emile. I've never heard of that award ceremony. At the Lumiere Awards in France, it was a nominee for Best Animated Film, but it didn't win. And at the Montreal Festival of New Cinema, that's a festival I have to go to sometime. It was nominated for the Louvre d'Or for the award for Best Film. It was nominated, but it didn't win. It didn't make a big splash upon its initial release in the United States. As a matter of fact, I check out the movies often, and even though I don't get to see every single film out there, I do have a general sense of what has been released. And if I haven't seen a film, I would at least be able to tell you whether or not it came out in theaters near me. And even though I'm near a metropolitan area, I'm not near a major metropolitan area, so there are some films that might have only been released in New York or LA if they were released in America at all, which I unfortunately do not get to see.
Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Words on Film. I always love talking about movies, and I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please subscribe and rate the show and leave comments if you can. I would love to get your feedback, even if it's more criticism than praise. This has been Words on Film. I'm Dan Burke, and until my next episode, I'll see you at the movies.